Nisiyem nisiyaya Thikum kuinem sep Hajjka siyem Nisiyem nisiyaya Anthes gachuya Talitin Homas kwe masteoch
You wait before the sunrise And at 5 a.m. you get on the bus The people look so resigned To the daily grind And you swear It'll never be
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Intersections, presented by CITR's Intersectionality Collective. We're here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m., we host a panel of collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, sexuality, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
Change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
Crimes and Treasons Radio, this is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM.
Yes, yes, you and I rock with the best, 101.9 CITR Radio. Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze. Right now you're rocking with Jules Andre Brown, Rolly Bells, Jamal Steels, and Horsepower. You know what it is, all right?
Yo, it's Iron Sue, man. I want to shout out Crimes and Treasons Radio, man. CITR 101.9, man. Turn up, turn up, turn up.
About 40% of UBC students experience food insecurity. Sprouts is hosting a weekly produce market from 10:30 to 1:30 every Monday in the Life Building. With produce from local farms, students are free to take whatever they want. Sprouts Cafe is open from Monday to Thursday and is offering 30 free meals a day, completely free and no questions asked. They also host Community Eats, a completely free hot lunch that is open for all. Stop by and support the Sprouts cause for sustainable, accessible food at UBC.
Okay, welcome back everyone to another episode of Intersections. I'm Juliana.
And I'm Phoebe.
And today we have another special guest episode for you. And on today's episode, we're going to be talking about the concept of decolonizing or indigenizing academia. We have two guests lined up on today's episode, and the first guest we'll be speaking to is Kate Gillis. Phoebe, do you want to introduce Kate for us?
I would love to. So Kate is a Métis grad student currently at the University of Saskatchewan in the Department of Indigenous Studies. Her thesis focuses on the role of Métis women in the ethnogenesis of the Métis Nation. During her studies, she did an internship with the Permanent Mission of Canada to the United Nations in New York City as the first ever Indigenous intern. Since then, she's accepted a position with the Métis National Council as a policy advisor in the Intergovernmental and International Relations Department. Welcome, Kate.
Thanks so much, Phoebe and Juliana. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So it's kind of funny. We have an ongoing joke on the show that I only invite my friends on. Well, it's not that I only invite my friends on. It's just that my friends keep coming on the show because we keep doing topics that are related to things that very cool people in my life have a lot of very cool things to say about. So when I heard this topic, I was like, oh, Kate and I have had a lot of very interesting conversations about her experience, you know, not just being Métis in academia, but also like about your studies and your thesis. So I thought, you know, it'd be very interesting to have you on. And I also just, you know, like talking to my friends on the radio, I guess.
Yeah, no, this worked out so well. I'm so happy to be here.
I met Kate when we worked at David's Tea in high school in Calgary, Alberta. Rest in peace, David's Tea. I think that our store location is one of the only ones left, though.
No, they shut it down.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I think there's still a location at Chinook Mall, but South Center has been gone for like years. After we left, really just went downhill. So
wow,
this could be an interesting investigation, because in Ontario, where I'm from, the David's Teas have also been disappearing. So what is happening to David?
David is bankrupt. That's what's happening. He's out of money. Okay, anyway, enough about David's Tea. I just wanted to, you know, give some fun background on how I met Kate. But yeah, so this episode is not about David's Tea, unfortunately. It is about the experiences of Indigenous people in academia. So before we get into learning more about your experiences, could you just take a moment to lay out to our listeners the difference between someone who is Métis versus Indigenous, and sort of just explain some of the language that we'll be using throughout this episode?
Yeah, for sure. So Canada has three recognized Indigenous peoples: First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. And so the Métis experience and identity, it's like very, very complex. Métis is a French term originally, and its literal translation is mixed. So there's a really big misinterpretation that Métis people are just mixed between like First Nations and settlers, which isn't totally the case. Métis people have a really distinct history that dates back to the late 1700s. And yeah, does that give a good kind of overlay?
That's great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
I thought we could start off, maybe Kate, we could talk about your undergrad experience first, what you studied, where you went, and what it was like for you, and sort of what made you decide to then pursue your master's after 4 years of undergrad.
Yeah, for sure. So I am born and raised in Calgary. I am Métis. My mom's side of my family is Métis. They're all from Winnipeg and surrounding small Métis communities around there. And so growing up, I really didn't know any Métis people aside from my family. And there's not a huge Métis community in Calgary. It's definitely grown within the past couple of years, but when I was growing up, I didn't really know any other Métis people. And so I'm very lucky to know that I am Métis. And like my mom really like pounded it into us when we were kids, like, you guys are Métis, this is who you are, this is your identity. And so I grew up very sure of my indigeneity, but didn't really grow up alongside any other Indigenous people. Calgary is very, very, very white. And so I did my undergraduate degree here in Calgary at a small Catholic university called St. Mary's University. It's in the deep southeast corner of Calgary. And I did my degree in history. And when I first started, I wanted to originally go into education and be a teacher. And that didn't last long because I realized that I hated children. Not to say that. Yeah, so I kind of had to reevaluate what I was doing, where I was going. And timing-wise, it worked out pretty well. In my third year of university, I took an Indigenous Studies class, and it was an introduction to Indigenous peoples in Canada, I think. And it was a history class. It was taught by a white woman. I was the only Indigenous person in the class. And I left feeling very, very, very pissed off. it was very, for lack of a better word, very colonial experience. It was all textbooks, reading, and then this white professor lecturing to us twice a week. And so I also felt very tokenized within the space as well, because it was oftentimes like, oh, Kate, what about you? What about your family? And like, I don't speak for all Indigenous peoples or all Métis peoples or like even my entire family as a whole, right? Like we all have such diverse experiences. And so it was in that exact moment that I realized that I myself had lots more to learn as well. And decided that I was going to pursue more education. And so I knew as well that I had to leave Calgary. The University of Calgary does have a, I guess, developing Indigenous studies program. They do have an Indigenous studies undergrad program, but nothing in graduate studies. So they have like a political science department and a history department and whatever else, but nothing you can get your master's in Indigenous studies. So that just kind of furthered my belief that I had to leave the city. And so I applied at the University of Saskatchewan and the University of Alberta, just because I knew that those were spaces that one had Indigenous studies programs, but two were also spaces where there were more Indigenous scholars. And so, yeah, I decided on University of Saskatchewan, and 3 years later, that's still where I am.
Hey, we're getting there. We're in the home stretch.
Slowly but surely, yeah.
So, I mean, we mentioned a bit at the beginning there, your research that you're doing in your master's is about Métis, the contributions of Métis women sort of in the Red River region throughout looking back at history. So maybe you could talk a bit about like your experience conducting research on the history of Métis women and any challenges you've sort of like come across in that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, honestly, it's just been a challenge altogether. It's definitely like a gap within the research, and which is why I did it to begin with. I took a position, like a summer student position, after I finished my undergrad, with the Rupert Sine Institute, which is an affiliate of the Métis Nation of Alberta. They have a triple mandate in research, education, and training. And so I was working in their education department, and we were trying to develop resources, Métis resources for teachers. And as we were developing resources, it's very clear in the history that there's like a male centric perspective that is there. it's very colonial in nature. It focuses lots on like men and, well, white men especially, and then when there are mentions of Métis people at all, it's typically in regards to men as well. And so me growing up in my family, it's my mom who's Métis. And then, so I learned about Métis culture and being Métis from my mom and largely from her aunties. So my great aunties. And as I was reading all this material on white men and Métis men and, whatever else, I didn't see myself reflected in that space or like what I knew about being Métis. It just wasn't there. And so that's how I came across my topic, and decided to put my history degree to use and apply it there. But yeah, it's been really challenging. In recent years, there has been more literature developed by mostly Métis women academics on the role that Métis women have played, both past and present, on nation building. But it is very limited. And so because it is a historical project, I did have to do like an archival component. And I went in and I was like, yeah, I'll just read between the lines. This will be easy. Like I'll find something no one's ever seen before and it'll be great. And so I did a couple weeks in Winnipeg. Winnipeg houses the Provincial Archives of Manitoba and the Hudson's Bay Company Archives as well. And you guys, I'm not kidding. I went in the first 2 days, actually. I was there for like 9 hours each day and did not find anything helpful. Like it was nothing helpful at all. And I was like reading like company journals and like just even trying to find like women's names, and nothing, like nothing at all. And so I really had to reapproach it and think of like a different way of doing things. And so a big component of my thesis is I use two Cree terms. One is Wakotwin, which translates roughly to kinship, and the other is Otepemsawak, which translates roughly to the people that own themselves. And they've been two terms that have been used to describe the Métis as a people. And so instead of looking for mentions of Métis women, I started looking for, reaching for straws of just any traces of like kinship I could find, any like families that I could find, and then any instances of the Métis being the people that own themselves. So Métis like rebelling, I guess, in a sense. And that was definitely much easier because people were racist. And yeah, and a lot of the source material was, I have one quote in mind. It's the Métis in Pembina, which is a community in South Dakota, are so much their own masters that the Hudson's Bay Company couldn't control them. And so it's cases like that that you can see this term Otepemsawak, like they're the people that own themselves, they're independent, so on and so forth. And so I did have a little bit more luck with that. But I was definitely stretching, like really, really stretching. And so, of course, my topic is Métis women. And so I had to find a way to bring Métis women into the topic, into my writing. And so I used like a genealogical reconstruction approach, essentially just building family trees, which was much more effective, but also at the same time, a lot of Indigenous women in the past, especially during this period, I'm looking at like roughly 1790 to 1840, Indigenous women aren't listed using their names. It's often just like Indian woman or Cree woman or Ojibwe woman, or so they're nameless in so many of the sources. And so that was a challenge as well. Just trying to like give justice, like give some sort of voice to these women who have been like so overlooked that nobody even knows their names. So yeah, I'm definitely rambling at this point, but it was very, very challenging. And then throwing COVID on top of all of this as well. When I originally started, I was hoping to do like in-person interviews with like contemporary Métis women talking about their experiences. And wasn't able to do that because COVID. So alas.
So many challenges, you know, talking about the difficulty you had in finding like traces of Métis women in the archives. And you said like, you know, in your experience as a, you know, finding education resources and they weren't there. So you thought, okay, I'll go looking for them myself, go looking for that resource myself, but it just wasn't there. It's a good example of like, it's funny, our show's called Intersections. It's about intersectionality, right? How it's like, not only are they, you know, Métis, and but they're all, the fact that they're Métis women leaves them sort of like even more erased historically. So this is why the work you're doing is so important. Well, so doing, I guess, you know, you're just in the finishing up, you know, Kate was telling me she finished writing and now is going into her defense, her oral defense of this research. But, you know, you've since, we talked about, transitioned into working for the Métis National Council. In the past, you talked to me about, you know, thinking about pursuing your PhD. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about what you decided to sort of, you know, leave academia, or if it's still on your mind maybe to one day, you know, do the PhD, and what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely multifaceted. Like I love school. I always have. I've always been good at it, which is definitely like a privilege. My parents are teachers, so I feel like they just really pounded that into us at a young age. Like you have to study, you have to do your homework, you have to do this, you have to do that. And so honestly, I just think that school has always been like a very safe space for me, which like as a fairly white passing Indigenous person is definitely a privilege that other Indigenous peoples don't have. But yeah, I've been very lucky to have had the experience that I have had. But honestly, it's just exhausting. Like it's so, so exhausting. And I think, like I've talked to some of my, colleagues and peers about this as well. Like when you're researching something that's so close to home for you, it's really draining. And like, there's so much trauma within like the topic even I'm looking at. And I mean, like my mom has always been like, no, we're Métis. This is a beautiful thing. Like, it's great to be Indigenous. Like, and she's always been really good at that, but she didn't have the same experience. And her, her father, my grandpa, still to this day, he's like, no, we're not Métis. We're just French Canadians. Like, he just, there's really this element of denial. And so going through this whole experience and trying to uncover like parts of the past, not just for myself, but like for the community, it's a huge weight on your shoulders. And it's really, really tiring. And so I'd love to go back one day. Like there's definitely just so much more work to be done in this space, but especially within the last year or so, I've really noticed just for burnout. It's just simply burnout. And so, yeah, I would love to get back to it one day, but gonna make that cash for the meantime because school's expensive as well. And yeah, hopefully one day get back into it.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Make that cash.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting to hear that it's still on your mind to go back and get your PhD or to continue through academia. And it's like, maybe from what you mentioned at your experience in your undergrad of being taught Indigenous studies by, you know, a white person, by a settler, and being able to like have more Indigenous people in academia being able to do that. Do you ever feel like when you were doing your master's, did you feel, you know, any sort of pressure to continue or to pursue a PhD and to like get into teaching so that there would be more Indigenous people in academia?
For sure. Yeah, definitely. I also TA'd throughout the first 2 years of my master's, or I guess 2.5 actually. I was TA'ing a Intro to Indigenous Peoples in Canada course, and it was taught by a couple different Indigenous professors, but I felt very obligated to participate in that. And I mean, typically TAing is just part of your graduate experience, like so many graduate students do it. But I also found that was like a really exhausting, mm-hmm. Especially it was a first level course. So you're getting a bunch of 18-year-olds from Saskatchewan, like rural Saskatchewan, who are like, we hate Indians, like, and writing these just super, super racist papers. And so it's both like devastating and also like inspiring, because it's really hard work, but it's also goes to show like what important work it is, right? Like, maybe this is actually a mandatory course now at the University of Saskatchewan for all students in liberal arts programs, education programs, and nursing programs. So, I mean, like, the goal ideally is if we're teaching this course, that these kind of like racist mentalities, they just disappear over time. And so there definitely is a pressure there. And then also during my studies, all these pretendians started to be discovered, right? Mm. Like Carrie Barrasso is the big one at University of Saskatchewan. And really, like, it takes a big toll on the community, but it's also like a fine reminder that if we as Indigenous people don't take up these spaces, these white people have no problem taking them up for us. And so, yeah, I think I'll leave it there.
Yeah, that's a really salient point that I didn't even like consider, all those news. I believe there was someone at UBC too. I can't remember off the top of my head who, but
Ellen Tappell.
Yeah.
Can't remember her last name, but.
Well, I think this like sort of transitions us into the next sort of set of questions we were going to talk to you about, like this concept of like decolonizing or indigenizing academia. And I'll hand it over to Juliana for some of that.
Great. Yeah. Well, just to follow up on something you previously said, when you said you were TAing for the Intro to Indigenous Studies course, I was going to actually ask if it was mandatory, because I would assume that if it was an elective, people would be interested and open to learning about that. So that was, I was like, oh, it's interesting that you received, you know, people handing in racist papers. But if you, as you said, it was, it's like now mandatory, which I think is a really good thing, because that kind of, that history needs to be taught. But it's definitely, it sounds like it takes a big, big toll. And I feel like there can be an expectation that Indigenous people are required to teach white people about the history, or settler Canadians about the history, when in reality it's really our responsibility to go out and do that work on our own time and not kind of assume or put that emotional toll on Indigenous people. So, but I was also interested, so you said at the beginning your first intro to Indigenous history was taught by a white person, and I'm wondering if you could talk to us about the difference from like a student perspective in terms of learning about Indigenous history being taught by like a white professor in a more like westernized or colonial or hierarchical kind of structure versus being taught a similar subject but from an Indigenous perspective or by an Indigenous professor. Do you have any takeaways or thoughts on how those two learning experiences are different from the perspective of a student?
Yeah, I mean, it's also going to be different in the sense that one was in my undergrad and one is in my master's, right? So, I mean, the profs that I had throughout my MA were mostly Indigenous, and the courses honestly were mostly conversational based. And so it was lots of, still lots of reading, but lots of reading from Indigenous authors, Indigenous academics, Indigenous scholars that have really like dedicated their lives and like lived experiences to this work. So it was lots of like pre-reading and then coming to class ready to talk and share our own experiences, how we relate to the works that we were reading, how we didn't relate. Say, for example, if we're reading like an Inuit piece done on whatever, like how does my experience as a Métis woman differ, or like how do I relate to that? And yeah, so I think the biggest difference would be just this conversational approach, as opposed to in my undergrad when I took that Indigenous Studies course, and then I took two more. Like, I obviously didn't learn my lesson very well because I was like, I'm going to keep doing this. But it was just like a burning rage at this point. I'm like, I have to see if it gets any better. It didn't in my undergrad, but lesson learned. Every course I took actually was just very, it was professors talking at you. They were lecturing, right? It wasn't conversational. It wasn't, no one provided input. And again, maybe that is just a difference between like undergrad versus master's, but I mean, even like the source material that we were looking at, like the I might still have it actually, the textbook that we used for the Intro to Indigenous Peoples in Canada, it was written by a white man, and then we also read The Inconvenient Indian from Thomas King, which I'm like, okay, you just Googled like the first Indigenous book in Canada, right? the source material was super different. And I mean, also like we took like theory classes and like methodology courses in my master's program that had like really like textbooks, but they were written still by Indigenous scholars. And I think even that, like just small, small, small difference makes a world of difference in a learning space.
Yeah, and I think back to some of the courses that I've taken that have been more in the realm of social justice or Indigenous studies. And they all, like, as you said, kind of have been, if they're Indigenous led, they've been more conversational based. And I find that it kind of just opens up the learning environment. Like it takes away the pressure, because instead of getting graded on like your knowledge or how well you understand this historical event or like current events that are still ongoing. You read the material and then you come in and you have a conversation and you learn from each other and you hear people's experiences. And it's always all the like the courses that I've taken that have been like that have always been a much better learning experience for me because I don't feel like I'm being graded on my knowledge or lack of knowledge. It's like a very open, collaborative, like community space. And I think there's a lot of value in that kind of learning and that kind of teaching. And I also think that historically Indigenous forms of knowledge have been regarded as like invalid or like not legit as when you compare it to Western-based forms of knowledge. And so I think having courses like that that kind of help people understand that there is a huge validity in Indigenous forms of knowledge and teaching is so important in learning those kinds of things. So and I'm also interested in hearing your thoughts on the difference between decolonization or decolonizing academia versus indigenizing academia.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, like in my experience, first of all, let me preface with saying like universities are colonial institutions, right? And there's really just no escape from that. So I think this idea of decolonizing can only get us so far within these spaces. And so like personally, I have a preference towards indigenizing, and I'll use the example. My youngest sister, actually, she just started this past September at the University of Guelph, and she's doing a Indigenous environmental science program. And it's a new program that they only introduced a couple years ago. And so I think it's still like kind of in a trial run, but it's all like Indigenous specific. So she's taking like a language course with an Anishinaabe like first language speaker and teacher. And so that's one element of it. It's also like largely land-based. And like, I'm not a science person at all, and she is, and that's great. But like, someday she'll send me photos and she's just like looking at trees and like painting photos of frogs. And this is all part of like reconnecting, right? And like this literal like removal from the classroom setting onto the land, like that's indigenizing universities, right? And yeah, and I would call it indigenizing as opposed to decolonizing, because this land-based learning thing, it's not colonial. Like you can't decolonize a classroom through land-based learning. You're instead like empowering an Indigenous worldview, I guess. And so yeah, that's one example that I've seen. I think looking at like decolonization also leads to a lot of tokenism, like hiring one Indigenous professor and being like, oh, we're decolonizing, here's so-and-so, like, welcome, will you do a land acknowledgement and a prayer for us? I feel like those are more attempts at decolonizing, when instead we should be looking at how do we bring elders into this space? Like, how do we indigenize and make sure that our Indigenous students are thriving and getting the resources and everything that they need? Does that make sense?
No, 100%. And I feel like the concept, or there's a lot of issues both within academia and society at large about kind of saying, okay, we're going to acknowledge this on one day and then pretend that, or like, and then not think about it for the rest of the year. So that is similar to what you were saying about hiring one Indigenous prof and then saying, oh, look, we're like doing, we're decolonizing. It feels like it's almost for show. Like it's not genuine almost.
Totally. Yeah. University of Saskatchewan also, like, they have a requirement that you include a land acknowledgement in your syllabus. And while like land acknowledgements are a good thing, it's also like, what is this actually doing for Indigenous peoples, right? So like you said, I feel like more of this decolonization talk is just for show, as opposed to like indigenizing, when there's like evident action there. Yeah, I guess that would be the difference in my head, at least.
I think you like laid out that difference really nicely for us. And it, I think it reminds me of what you said earlier about, you know, even taking at your master's level, like research methods courses that had resources and textbooks that were like written by Indigenous people. It's like, even if it's not necessarily on a topic, like in an Indigenous studies course, it's like, you know, Indigenous people's work and perspective should be incorporated sort of like across the board, like even in the sciences, where I like they're probably, you know, a lot less representation of Indigenous scholars, you know, in the sciences compared to like the arts even. So I think just, yeah, having, I think that was a good point to have, yeah, you know, resources and textbooks in across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe just to wrap up, you can talk about how, you know, you navigate this concept of like indigenizing in this, like on like the governmental level that you're working on now with like the Métis National Council. Like, how do you think that compares to what we see happening in academia?
Yeah, I mean, well, at the very, very surface level answer, the Métis National Council is Indigenous owned and operated, right? Like we have a president who's Métis, who's democratically elected. I think probably 60 to 75% of our staff is Métis. We work directly with community. And so I don't want to bore anyone with the politics or the structure of the Métis National Council, but we work with the four provincial governments. So Métis Nation British Columbia, Métis Nation Alberta, Métis Nation Saskatchewan, and Métis Nation of Ontario. And we get our mandate from them. So it's really like grassroots, ground up, that we do our work in. And yeah, so the citizens of the Métis Nation of Alberta, for example, they democratically elect their president who, and then they like outline principles that they send to us, and we work within that mandate that they provide us. And so it's just really, really, really community-based, which is fantastic. And I mean, like, I've also worked for like the Government of Canada, and that's not the case there. Yeah, so it's definitely like the Government of Canada takes like a land acknowledgement approach, whereas like the Métis National Council, it's like ground up, like learning from community, working with community, which is really fantastic. And comparing that to academia, I'm very privileged to have done my my master's program in the realm of Indigenous studies when you're working with community members, like my supervisor, Allison Stevenson. She's also a Métis woman. Like I said before, most of my profs were Indigenous. Most of my peers were Indigenous. I'm definitely like at a disadvantage because I did my my coursework through COVID. But I mean, the Métis Nation, or not Métis Nation, Saskatchewan, sorry. The University of Saskatchewan, they work really closely with all the surrounding Indigenous communities. So there's, I think there's six surrounding nations, and then the Métis Nation of Saskatchewan as well, they have really close ties with. So yeah, and I know that's probably not the same experience, like you said, Phoebe, for someone who's like in a Master's of Science in Engineering or something, right? Like it's probably a little bit different there, but those community ties are definitely existent. And when you have Indigenous staff and students from those communities, that really enables and empowers those relationships as well. I guess my last kind of thoughts would be that academia, because it is such a colonial space, it is inherently difficult for Indigenous peoples. And I mean, like scholarships can only take us so far. And so there needs to be, like we discussed, this active like indigenizing of these institutions in order to enable more people to access them. And I think I've been very privileged with my experience, but I know that many other Indigenous people have not been. So
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And if people want to find you, where can they find you? Where can they find your work?
Yeah, I'm hoping to defend my thesis within the next couple months. And so the title of it is Mothering a Nation, the Role of Métis Women Within the Métis Ethnogenesis. And so the University of Saskatchewan will publish that. I'm also happy to share it with you guys when it's officially done. knock on wood. I'm also on Twitter at KateGillis9. My Instagram is KateGillis. Always happy to answer any questions about Métis or like Indigenous experiences in academia. And I guess my best email as well is KateG@MétisNation.ca. A little self-plug. Read my thesis, please. I worked really hard on it.
Well, I, for one, can't wait to read it.
Yeah, congratulations. Early congratulations for having it almost finished, and good luck defending it. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, please stay tuned. And after the break, we will be back with our next guest in this episode of Intersection. So don't go away.
It's alive. Megamall's debut EP, Escape from Lizard City, goes live on Friday, July 1st. Buy the cassette and lyric book on Bandcamp or stream wherever you listen to music. For the last 2.5 years, you could avoid everyone except yourself. Welcome to Lizard City.
Whoa, hold on. Where are you taking all those cacti?
I need to put them near the radio.
How come?
They love to hear Everly's nature-based music on Dead Succulent Haunt every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CITR 101.9.
Oh, Dead Succulent Haunt? Where your plants can grow and you can mourn those you've lost?
Come on, plants, let's grow.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca. to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% Indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
Welcome back to Intersections, and welcome back to this episode about Indigenous academia. In this interview, we are joined by Panina Sarah Lynn Harding, who is an Indigenous scholar and TikTok content creator. Welcome to the show, Panina.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Can you introduce yourself and share what you're currently working on in your PhD in Natural Resources and Environmental Studies?
Yes. Like you've said, my name is Panina Sarah Lynn Harding, and I am a member of the Esketem. We belong to the Tsleil-Waututh M'kulup, the Shuswap Nation, and I'm on the cusp of my 4th year in my PhD candidacy at the University of Northern British Columbia. I'm a mother of 4, and yes, I am a content creator now. I actually had some internal struggles with acknowledging myself as a content creator, but it is what I do. It's also from training that I received through the National Screen Institute and the TikTok Accelerator for Indigenous Creators in 2021. My areas of research specialization are Indigenous environmental planning, Indigenous research methodologies, and experience of place. And I'm coming at experience of place from hermeneutic phenomenology and also through the lens of settler placemaking. So that's where my research lies. And the title of my dissertation is Documenting Eskenum Experience of Place to Prepare for Generative Land Use Planning. So that's, in a nutshell, what I'm doing. And my preferred name is Panina. that was my name before I was even born. My great-grandmother and her sister named me. And it was my great-grandmother's name when she was a child before she was taken to the St. Joseph's Mission. Her father was Symphorian, and in order to register his children in the St. Joseph's Mission, the priests renamed him so that they could register his children. And so her name was changed from Panina to Alice Jack Symphorian, and her father was given the name Jack Symphorian. So that's where the name comes from. Also, when I was born back in the early 80s, it wasn't safe to identify our Indigenous children with traditional or ancestral names on our birth certificates, which is why it's not on my birth certificate. But it's always been my name. I just started leaning into my name really in 2018 as I was beginning my master's program. So here I am today, and I do prefer Panina. I still respond to Sarah Lynn, and Harding is my married name from my former marriage.
Thank you for sharing. I think it's really interesting when people talk about specifically like the history of names and like how they're carried through family and like the cultural legacy that they hold and the importance. So thank you for sharing. It's also very interesting that you shared your hesitation to identify as a content creator, because that's actually how I was introduced to you. When I first got TikTok, like many people during COVID-19, I was scrolling and I came across one of your probably earlier TikToks talking about your PhD program and this life of being an Indigenous PhD student, a parent, and then like talking about all of these, and you kind of approached it with this humor that I really like. So I immediately followed you. So I'm really curious. Also, your handle is Academic Auntie, which I think is very clever. So you share, as I mentioned, you share like book recommendations, your PhD journey, and teaching now that you started teaching. So can you share what inspired you to start your TikTok?
So while I was in my master's program, this is something I started on my Instagram, actually, around late 2017, before I started my master's. I was transitioning from undergrad to master's, and I began treating my Instagram almost as a blog. So I would post photos of what I was doing as an undergraduate student, and I would explain what's happening in the photo or what's going on around that time in my educational journey. And it's something that grew from there. So, and then I discovered TikTok. Yeah, I discovered TikTok at the beginning of the pandemic. So when the world locked down, I was like, okay, what's going on over here? And at first I was just lurking on other people's pages and watching what they were doing and learning how they share their message. And then I started thinking, well, how can I expand on what I share on my Instagram page? Because I used to share the work I was doing as the president of the Northern BC Graduate Student Society. I would use that to recruit students for volunteer opportunities that were available throughout the university campus. Or I would provide updates on, you know, how myself and my children were doing. And as I transitioned from my master's to my PhD, I thought, okay, how can I have more control over the narrative of my journey to PhD? And so that's where I started leaning into my TikTok and trying to understand, you know, what kind of message do I want to be a part of? How do I want to share this journey in a way that's relatable across genders, across cultures? And really, you can be from any background and get into a PhD program. The experience in a doctoral degree is common, and there are so many commonalities that I experience with non-Indigenous scholars. So I started sharing what it's like to be an Indigenous woman navigating graduate studies, navigating a PhD. And then as I got more comfortable and I had the training from the TikTok Accelerator program, I began to open up more and take a few more risks with the content that I was creating. So I got more comfortable in the app and started learning how to edit my content in a way that makes it more engaging for my audience. And I enjoy TikTok a lot more than any of the other social media apps now. It's more comfortable for me, and I can really curate an experience for my mutuals because my mutuals get different content than the public does. And my rule is that I don't post photos of my youngest child or content with my youngest child. She does like to do TikTok dances with me, but those are published in my private posts. That's not something anyone in the public will ever see unless my phone gets stolen and someone gets access to my content.
Yeah, I like how you mentioned that you're able to cater like a different experience for people who like follow you in your mutuals, which I am very proud to be one of those. But it is, I think it really does allow creators to craft, like, you know, because there's it's like your private stories on Instagram. Like there's some things you just don't want to share with the entire world and you shouldn't have to, but you know, you're able to create more of that community while still, you know, it's understanding that you're still like this social media persona, you know, it's still crafted through the lens of your camera, but I think you're able to open up a bit more, which is great. Like when you're following someone, I feel like it, I don't know, it brings a more humanity to this person you're following.
And that's really the intention of my content, is to humanize this experience of becoming the expert. Mm-hmm. And I find it's very awkward when I'm referred to as an expert, which I have been on a few occasions now. And I need to be comfortable with being uncomfortable in that lens of being an expert. I'm not somebody who's ever enjoyed being put on a pedestal, because as far as I'm concerned, if you're on a pedestal, you have farther to fall. And I would rather be authentic. I would rather share, you know, small portions of my experience. And sometimes that's enough to help another student get through a really hard week. And we all have those weeks where it could be really devastating, whether it's, you know, a grade we receive or an inappropriate comment from a faculty member, or it could be just the overwhelm of all the tasks and deadlines that we have. So I tried to show that I too have those experiences while I'm building my specialization, so that it's humanizing the experience. I'm not just flying through my program with no barriers. I'm navigating a system that wasn't designed for me to ever enter, you know, because up until 1961, any status Indian in Canada would actually be enfranchised. They would lose their status if they became a doctor, a lawyer, or a member of clergy. So I was never intended to be in academia, especially as an Indigenous woman. So I'm mindful of that. And I try to show that while it's very difficult to navigate these systems as an Indigenous woman, that it's possible and that we can, you know, showcase our excellence as well.
Absolutely. And it sounds like you also have a very good balance of managing representation while also managing boundaries in your own personal life, which is so important for content creators as well. Mm-hmm. So with the TikTok becoming a content creator and becoming recognized as a content creator, you also recently hosted a workshop at Simon Fraser University called TikTok for Academia. Have you observed any TikTok trends that particularly have accelerated knowledge mobilization and public awareness about certain research topics or research areas?
I haven't noticed any trends other than when we're talking about something that's like COVID-19. There seems to be a lot of efforts to address misinformation, but there's also pockets of society that really are, they don't believe that COVID-19 is real, and that's their lens. Everyone is entitled to their own perspective, but it really takes a trigger point, you know, for an academic to be able to jump in. And I haven't seen many go viral for speaking on serious topics. It's usually, for example, I was once following an account, I came across a professor in the United States of America who his post went viral because he was making a joke of how professors are perceived to grade assignments for their students. And so he went and he was standing at the top of a flight of stairs in his institution and holding a stack of papers. And then on each stair, he had A, B, C, D, F. And so he threw the papers, and wherever the papers landed on the stairs, that's the grade that the students received. And I thought it was so funny. So that's the type of content that tends to get more attention when it comes to academia. I'm very niche when I share content on being an Indigenous scholar. And I think that's part of why my page hasn't grown so fast in comparison to the other creators that I took the training from, TikTok and the National Screen Institute. They share in their own way, and they have their own style of content. And some of them are actors, artists, they're performers. So there's something that people can purchase or support from them. And for me, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to download a PDF of an article that I publish or cite it in your journal article. So it's, my audience is just different. And so I came to terms with the fact that I'm not probably going to go viral the way other people do. And really, that's okay with me. I don't need to go viral because there is a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And when it comes to trends, I find it's actually what I get more engagement with, and this is really odd, is when I post really simple content of me just walking around campus. You know, I walked up a flight of stairs in my orange shirt and my ribbon skirt. I crouched down and I, you know, held my fist up, and I was speaking about being the first person from my community to gain entry into a PhD program, and that I wouldn't be the last. There are more coming behind me. And that content, I think, ended up around 25,000 views. So that for me was going viral. But for other creators, that's like their daily view count, right? So when you're posting academic content, I think I get pretty good views for somebody who is in university, in a university community, and sharing academic content. But that's because I'm very niche. And I accept that, I embrace it, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with connecting with those who genuinely need to see someone like me, who is also someone like them, just trying to get through these university programs that are really intense and demanding.
Yeah, for sure. And I think I really appreciate this approach that you have of like recognizing, like, it seems like you've put a lot of care and thought into this community and the way that you approach TikTok, as you know, like, yeah, you recognize where your content is, like who your viewers are, which I think is, you know, when we have this conversation about like influencers and TikTokers, it's very much like around like, how many views can you get? How viral can you go? Which, you know, isn't the dream for everyone. So kind of reaching more of this connection between TikTok and your work in academia. So you created a TikTok video describing how Indigenous representation at the peer review level promotes a sense of belonging in academia. So how would you describe the current Indigenous peer review space?
I find that I don't know how many other Indigenous people are contributing to peer review processes.
Right.
And it's because it's a sub problem of the problem that society thinks Indigenous people are disappearing or have disappeared or we're no longer here. And that's the dominant narrative across the country. And when you apply that in an academic setting, the assumption by most is that Indigenous people don't make it into a bachelor's degree or complete a bachelor's degree, much less get into a master's or a PhD, which, you know, PhD is a terminal degree. So there is this nation state narrative that, like, why would we need to include Indigenous people in the peer reviewed process? And I know that there is a lot of movement and a lot of change in this area right now. But the reason I made that content was so that the Indigenous scholars that follow my page or come across my content see that somebody like them is already engaging in the peer-reviewed process, because I have done peer review on 4 occasions so far, and there will be more opportunities for me to contribute to peer review. And so I've done peer review for non-Indigenous scholars, and I actually had an opportunity last August to provide face-to-face feedback virtually with students whose work I had peer reviewed. And that was more meaningful to them because I could give them real-time feedback on the writing that they were providing. I got to connect with them. And for me, relations are so important. Being able to connect with other people and see where they're at, read their energy, and provide them with support and guidance, mentorship where necessary, when they're ready, you know, and at their level, because not everybody needs the same level of mentorship. So I'm just pulling up my analytics to see. I just wanted to share this little update with you. Pretty much since the beginning of my TikTok account, my page, I've had primarily female identifying followers. And that has been consistent throughout. Right now I'm at 79% female identifying followers and 21% male. But the most interesting for me here is that I actually have 7% of my followers are in Nigeria. And it shows me that when I'm logged into the app. Like, how did Nigeria find me? But it's a global community. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate about the app. I have 51% of my followers in Canada and 40% are from the United States. 1% in the United Kingdom and 1% in Australia, which, I mean, that's not bad. For a very small academic page, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure. When you were talking about the, you know, this issue of like who's doing peer review, one of the only serious TikTok videos I ever created was a series of videos talking about like who citations are. So when we read a paper, we don't tend to look at who's cited in the paper, and it's like very predominantly white male scholars are being cited. So do you think this like issue with a lack of representation, it kind of goes in with that, like, you know, citations, there's not representation of women of color, BIPOC community, Indigenous scholars. So this lack of Indigenous representation in the peer review community is just a further reflection of that.
It is. It's also a matter of access too, right? Mm-hmm. So who is academia originally set up to benefit? White male scholars, mm-hmm. who typically end up with, you know, a wife and children, and the wife is the one who looks after home, who looks after the children. The children, you know, have better opportunity because of the role that their father plays in academia. And then we see examples throughout history where the wife is also a scientist, but she's not recognized as a scientist, and she's writing the work of her husband and he's being published and her name is not being recognized. So there is this underpinning of exclusion for anyone who's not a white male. Now that is changing. We know that that's changing, but it's not changing fast enough. And when it comes to BIPOC community and like those who belong to LGBTQ, 2T+ community, it's harder to worry about being published when you're consistently worried about your safety. And for myself as an Indigenous woman, I'm 12 times more likely to go missing or be murdered than any other ethnic background woman in the country of Canada. So there is, you know, that portion of oppression that we need to overcome. It's very difficult to be solely focused on publishing in peer-reviewed journal articles when you are also parenting. And I mean, for example, last week, one of my children needed to have surgery, but my students also need their grades. And I'm the one who does pickups and drop-offs and all of these things. So there's parenting responsibilities on top of my PhD responsibilities. Does that mean I'm going to give up on publishing? No. My publishing process just is different, and it has to be. And I also have to bear in mind that I'm doing really well for somebody who's not supposed to be in academia. I am. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that I can now get recognition for the years of hard work that I've put into establishing myself as a scholar.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a very important point, like when you're talking about the way academia is structured and like who it's built for and the type of life and privileges that it's based upon. I think a large part of that is the fact that so much of it is unpaid labor and like who can afford to do unpaid labor. So just building on that, in your TikToks, you offer what I would say an honest look at doing a PhD, a dissertation. So you kind of break down this like air of mystery that institutions like to have around like, what is it like to do a PhD, right? Like we, you know, as an undergraduate who's about to graduate and like thinking about doing some sort of, you know, postgrad program, it's very intimidating because I find I either run into PhD students that their entire life is miserable and they hate everything about it and it's the worst thing they've ever done and you should never do this and you're not going to be able to do it. It's so hard, which is obviously not very encouraging. Or you run into people that don't want to tell you anything and they're like, oh, like, you know, I'm doing, and they make it so overly complicated that it just, you know, it really restricts access. So I'm wondering, and you kind of already spoke on this, but like, what is your overall goal of, you know, making this information very accessible to your followers?
Really want to see, I want other people to see that if you choose to go on this journey, you can do it. You can go through your bachelor's degree, your, if you choose to, you know, go and do the master's part and not fast track to a PhD from an undergrad honors thesis, which that's an option that nobody talks about. You can fast track in Canada from an undergraduate bachelor's thesis to a PhD and just skip the master's altogether. That's not a route for everyone, because some of us really like to have all the experiences, and that's a very personal decision to make. But I want others to see that you can come from any background, and if you want to do this work and live this lifestyle, it can be done. It just requires, it requires a personal commitment that to see it through to the end, and it gets really hard to see it through. I found for me the hardest times to make it through were the third year of my bachelor's degree, because it was like being in the middle of the tunnel where I'm too far from the beginning and I'm so far from the end, and it just feels like you're stuck in this dark spot. And I also found this past year, my PhD program, which is the third year of my PhD program, this was a really challenging year for me on a personal level, because as I go through my research and I'm seeing and confronted with so much colonization and so many aspects of how Indigenous people around the world have been targeted, specifically targeted, it becomes overwhelming, and it starts feeling like, what, who do I think I am that I can take on these institutions, that I can take on these notions of who belongs in academia? And it's really easy to get stuck in that mindset. And I found that the biggest challenge was pulling myself out of that mindset and reminding myself that I have earned my seat in my program. It was not handed to me. I didn't even know that I was doing a PhD interview with the chair of my department. We just went for coffee. I thought we were just going for coffee, but no, it was a PhD interview. And sometimes when you allow yourself to be open to the fear of change, that's when you really find out who you are and what you're made of. So it's learning to become open to that fear, the fear of the unknown. I don't know if that answered your question. I'm going off on tangents like a typical PhD person.
No, I think it definitely does. And again, that's what I appreciate about following you. Like you're not shying away from the fact that it's hard. Like no one's going to, you know, say that doing a PhD isn't hard. It is a lot of work. And I think also it's not like a job where you go to the office and then you leave. You know, most of us are working in our bedrooms. Like I'm doing this interview in my bedroom. Like it's, our lives are so mixed now. And so, but I appreciate that you're not doing it in a way that's meant to, you know, I don't know. It's like when you're a kid and you dream, right? Like you're not destroying dreams. You're just putting a little bit of like a reality scope on a dream, which I think is really good. And I think like personally following your content makes me feel like more motivated that I could do something after I graduate, you know, like further in academia, and that it's not, you know, something that we, you know, should shy away from, or, you know, but I think it's important to know what you're getting into. So I really appreciate that. Thank you for answering.
Absolutely. And remember that when you find yourself getting stuck in your studies, or you feel like you're not making any progress, it's more important to shift the focus from motivating yourself, like this motivation terminology that we get exposed to in academia. It's not about motivation, because if you weren't motivated, you wouldn't have applied to the program mm-hmm. in the first place. You wouldn't have made it through your first year. You wouldn't have kept going to classes. You have motivation. What you need to do is shift your thinking to momentum. Mm-hmm. How can I build momentum for myself in my learning process? What is in my best interests? How can I strengthen my skills? Because really what you're doing too is building your own specialization. Whether you're at the undergraduate level, the master's, or the PhD level, you're building your specialization and your areas of knowledge base, right? So rebuilding momentum when we get stuck is where the focus should go to. And that's how I've pulled myself out of that awful mindset I found myself mm-hmm. in this past year. I was like, it's not a motivation problem. I need to rebuild my momentum. I'm losing momentum, and that's why I'm panicking. So I began setting those smaller milestones. You know, how do I rebuild my momentum? And that's by identifying smaller targets that get me to the big target. And it's made a world of difference for me in the past year. And also just learning how to set and hold boundaries for myself. You know, like, for instance, I don't take phone calls or emails. I don't respond to any of that after 9 p.m. unless it's my children or my immediate family members. If there's an emergency with my friend, of course, like my closest friends know that they can call me at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm fine with that. But, you know, if the president of the university emails at 9:01 because something's happening, like, I was the president during job action at UNBC in 2019-20 of the Grad Student Society, and I would get emails all hours of the night from graduate students who were very concerned about passing, like getting through their practicum hours, students who weren't sure if they were going to be able to stay in Canada if they couldn't complete their degree programs that year. To students who believe that the Grad Student Society should be standing up and fighting with the union. And it's like, but our responsibilities as a graduate student society are different from that of a union. A student society represents all students. A union represents members of that union. And so I made a point after that year of being president, just before lockdown, to stop responding to outside emails and phone calls and text messages after 9 p.m. Even on my TikTok, I don't respond to messages from those who message me after, I'd say, 10 o'clock, because that's my private time with my family. And there's no reason to be messaging with anybody outside of my immediate family. So having those boundaries is really important, and it saves you a lot of mental load that you don't need to carry.
Yeah, and I have to agree with you. As someone who's done an undergraduate thesis and is now working on my master's, I think that, you know, we see a lot of boundaries set with professors. You know, they say right off the gate, like, I don't respond to emails after 9 p.m. I don't respond on weekends. But I think those boundaries can really be lost as a student. You know, you check your email and you see like, oh my gosh, I got an email from someone important. Like, I have to respond right away, even though it's me time. And I think that can really be a big play on mental health, kind of in the way that you talked about, where it's like impeding on any sort of personal boundaries you have. So I think it's really important to establish that. And it's it sounds like you do a great job of doing that.
I'm getting better now. My boundaries are better now, but it has taken me time to, I had to do some healing work on me to be able to stop that people pleasing behavior that it's so easy for me to go into people pleasing mode, and the boundaries are to help me stop that behavior, because I don't need to please the world. It's okay to just be who I am in my process, and you either vibe with it or you don't.
Absolutely. And so going into more of your PhD, part of what you're dealing with is engaging with the Esquenem community. You recently made your two-part TikTok that reviewed the application process that you have to go through with the Esquenem research community. And it's the Esquenem Traditional Knowledge and Research Ethics Policy, where you reviewed all of the questions that you had to go through. Can you share a little bit more about the sort of lessons that you've learned and experiences that you've had learning about the ethics of community engagement from PhD work and the standpoint of just doing research?
So the ethics approach that I take to all the work I'm a part of in my PhD is heavily informed by the traditional teachings I was raised with in my community and in my family group, indigenous knowledge that I've had access to throughout my life. You know, it's very relational. And so my research methodology for my PhD is based on the Esquenem traditional governance structure. That is my research methodology, because when you think of research methodology, really it's a framework for how you're going to make decisions in your research process. And when I was in my master's and I was trying to find a way to decolonize my research methodology, I finally, it's like you don't know what you need to know until you need to know it. And it's like I was finally ready to see it, and it was literally right in front of me on my desk. And it was our traditional governance structure, a diagram of our governance structure. And that reminded me of the work that Margaret Kovach has been doing in her research. She published, I think it was 2008, 2009, in Indigenous Research Methodologies. She published the Tribal-Centered Research Framework, and it describes the relationality in community. So it's also creates this space for conversation around the R's of Indigenous research. So there's 3 R's, there's 4 R's, there's 6 R's. There's all kinds of R's within Indigenous research, but it all comes back to respect, reciprocity, relationships, and depending on who you're reading or citing, it could be redistribution or relevance. All of these have the researcher focus on what are the relationships in community. Who has the authority to speak on behalf of a family group? Who has the authority to speak on behalf of a group of family groups? And so once you start to understand the traditional governance structure of an Indigenous nation, then you're able to start thinking about, how do I ethically conduct my research and make decisions in a way that is meaningful to the community first? And then, you know, somewhere down at the end, you also get your degree. But positioning community voice, community needs first throughout the process is how you build ethical research with Indigenous communities. It should never be about just what the researcher can extract from community, because we've had enough of that. As Indigenous people, we've had enough of researchers coming into our communities, taking what they want, what they need, leaving, never reporting back about what the results of the research were, never really acknowledging the relationships that researcher had to build in community to get access to that information. And also doing ethical research in Indigenous communities, I really disdain using the terminology of like data collection, data analysis, because for me, it's more about co-producing knowledge. And when I think of co-producing knowledge, that also includes team-based research projects in a lab. Every person on that team in the lab is co-producing knowledge. Whether you want to see that or not depends on the type of readings that you do. But I see lab work as co-producing knowledge together. Yes, there is somebody that, you know, they get first author on the paper, but there were so many other people that had to be part of that learning relationship. And that's why we're supposed to be listing everybody else who did that work on that paper and to gather that data and do that data analysis. So I try to approach my work from a spirit of co-producing knowledge I did start learning more and more about collective story work through the work of, she was given an honorary doctorate of law at UNBC, and I have her book downstairs, but she focuses on Indigenous story work, and her seminal work was about applying narrative and this collective story to Indigenous research, Indigenous-led research. I'm trying to remember her name. I'll have to email it to you. There's so many Indigenous scholars that I've drawn on for my work, like Dr. Adam Gaudry, and the principles of insurgent research and making sure that research is first and foremost meaningful to Indigenous community. If it doesn't have actionable portions that community can follow, you know, from the data analysis to implement change in the community that they want to see, then why are you doing the work? Why are you taking up their time? Because most Indigenous communities are in a crisis state most of the time. And researchers like myself need to be aware of that. And that we have a positional superiority, essentially, as researchers. We're seen as, you know, we can come into community whenever we want and we can leave whenever we want. So how do you build relationship when that's the perception of researchers? And that's the challenge that we're faced with now. How can we as researchers demonstrate our commitment to the relationships that we're building in Indigenous communities? And it's through meaningful action that upholds the voices and the priorities of Indigenous community. So that's what I've been learning about and how I've been approaching ethics in my research. My ethics are guided by my people's hereditary governance structure, because we have a system of decision making that has been fine-tuned and adapted over thousands and thousands of years. And it worked, and it's still working. We're just in this process of revitalizing those governance structures.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing all of that. That's a really powerful change that needs to happen in ethics and research. Particularly in the extraction idea of what research has taken from so many vulnerable communities and how to go about changing that and really provide meaningful change. So I appreciate you talking about that. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think that's a great place. That's all the time we have today. But thank you so much for coming on the show. I was very excited when we finally found a time for you to come on Intersections. We initially tried to get you for our TikTok episode, but we still got to talk about TikTok. So I'm very happy about that. But thank you so much for Panina for joining us today.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. I wish you both the best in your future and in any goals that you set for yourself. Just know that if your heart can believe it, you can achieve it. So keep going, even when it gets really hard. All right.
Thanks for listening to Intersections by CITR's Intersectionality Collective on 101.9 FM. We would love to be reached by email at intersectionalitycollective@citr.ca or on Instagram at intersectionality_CITR. Send us your comments, feedback, and episode ideas. You can also find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program, and our theme song is provided by Young and Sexy. Tune in on Tuesday at 10 a.m., 2 weeks from now, for the next episode.
Listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Straight out the fucking dungeon. We'll be right back.
counting double ones off of craps. I just like my funds double back. I am not the one. Why you think the food's double wrapped? We are in the land of the jacks. This is not for fun. Nights when the flashlights attack. They don't want me ever coming back. They don't want me ever coming back. Had me doing lunges and reps. This is just a domino effect. Matter of fact, bring another stack. I'ma do this all in 30 packs. This is for the motherfucking trap. The ones with the choppers on deck. This is for the gold. I do this for the ice on my neck. I do this for the fucking respect. This is for the hood. I am just a street ghetto vet. And this is my street silhouette.
We were